So I don't know if any of you are personally familiar with Evagrius Ponticus, the 4th-century desert father. I read him frequently, to get to sleep. He invented the seven deadly sins, although he thought there were eight of them. That's his main claim to fame. I won't tell you what the extra one was. You'll have to guess for yourselves. But there's this fantastic bit in Evagrius where he talks about the noonday demon, the demon of listlessness, because it attacks the monk in the middle of the day when he's been sitting in his cell reading some edifying but dull tome. And he finds, as the demon attacks him, he finds himself staring out the window, wondering why the sun has slowed down, wondering why no one's come to visit him. And my favourite bit, he gets distracted by the book itself. He holds it up and tries to work out whether the number of pages he's already read are greater than the number of pages he's still got to come. And I don't know about you, but I often find the noonday demon creeping up on me when I'm sitting listening to people talk in seminars and things, and I find myself staring at the piles of paper they've got in front of them and trying to work out which one is, bigger. So the point of all that is to say, you can't do that today because I've got this instead of a pile of papers. So you have no idea how long I'm going to go on for. And the reason for that is that what I have isn't exactly a proper polished paper, for which I apologise. It's more a bunch of problems and some possible solutions that I don't think work. So what I'm going to do is try to explain to you what the problem is I'm interested in and some of the possible solutions that don't seem to work. And that will lead up to the very unsatisfactory conclusion that I wonder if any of you have got ideas for how better to tackle these sorts of problems. So just to give a very brief bit of background, I'm a philosopher, but I do philosophy of religion, and I kind of have a background in theology. I don't have a background in metaphysics or sort of philosophy of science or any of that side of things. And my understanding is that most people here are more on the metaphysics, science-y sort of side rather than theology. Would that be right, roughly? Right, so you won't know where I go wrong theologically, but you'll jump on me metaphysically. That's sort of what I was expecting. So what I'm going to do is I think spend most of my time talking about the theological problems that I'm interested in, and then just go over some of the metaphysical possible answers that I will get wrong. And just to say as well, I'm approaching this because some of the stuff I'm going to talk about is quite weird and sort of abstruse. I come at it, the way I view theological issues like this as a philosopher is kind of as massive thought experiments. So like I'm going to talk about original sin and things like that, and that's not even very fashionable among theologians today, let alone philosophers. But I find them interesting just as, thought experiments to see how we think of identity, human nature, responsibility, various sort of more general philosophical topics that come up. So that's kind of my apology for talking about some of the weirder aspects of Christian theology in a not necessarily theological context. All right, so here's the thing. In Christian theology, there's a lot of pretty weird doctrines, basically, and doctrines that seem to make no sense. That's, my professional theological appraisal of the matter. So things like the doctrine of the Trinity, everyone knows, seems to be a contradiction. You've got three divine persons and yet they're one God. Or the doctrine of the Incarnation. Jesus is fully divine and yet he's also fully human, even though those seem to be completely contradictory things. And there are other examples like this as well. And philosophical theologians these days, and in the past, spill a lot of ink trying to find ways to make these make sense, or at least not be quite too intolerably absurd. What I want to suggest is that the apparent problems in a lot of Christian theological doctrines, and maybe other religions as well, but I'm not going to talk about that, really come down to the same problem. So rather than a lot of different weirdnesses, we've only got one weirdness, really. And if I'm right about that, I think that's quite a good advance because, we've minimised the problems. But it also means that if we can find a solution to one of them, it might work as a solution to the others as well. So that's why it's theologically important. So what I'm going to suggest is that the problematic Christian doctrines, at least the ones I'm going to talk about, all revolve around identity. In each case, we've got two or more things that seem in some sense to be identical, and yet in some other sense not to be identical. And that's where the apparent contradictions, the apparent problems arise. Because, of course, the classical notion of identity doesn't allow that. Two things are either identical, in which case they're one thing, or they're not. You know, A equals B, or it doesn't equal B. There's no matter of degrees. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to talk about these doctrines in turn, the ones that I think conform to this pattern. I'll say more about some than others. And then I'll try to talk about, well, whether there might be a way around it. So the first one I will say almost nothing about because it's too familiar is the doctrine of the Trinity. Okay, like I just said, you've got the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, but there's kind of only one of them. There's only one of them as regards godness, but there's three of them as regards persons. They've got to be properly distinct from each other, or that's the modalist heresy if you say they're not properly distinct. But at the same time, they've got to be genuinely one God and not really distinct from each other. Otherwise, you're a tritheist or an Arian or something horrible like that. So this is, you know, vast pages have been written about this over history. I won't go into it now, but you can see this is a problem of sort of identity, okay? The three persons of the Trinity are sort of identical in some sense, and yet they're not identical in some other sense. And all of the theologizing about the Trinity has been to try to find a way to explain how that can be. Okay, so that's the first one, the Trinity. Second one, which again I've already mentioned, the Incarnation. As Anna will attest, we have ourselves spilt a great deal of ink over trying to work out whether the doctrine of the Incarnation can make sense or not. There are lots of different ways to flesh it out, as it were, but the traditional one in traditional Christian orthodoxy has been to see Christ as two things sort of glued together. He has a divine nature, which is which is the second person of the Trinity, the Son, the Logos. And he also has a human nature, which is a sort of concrete particular. It's a thing. And the Incarnation consists of the divine part kind of acquiring the human part. And orthodoxy tells us that when this happens, Christ constitutes a single person. So he's not a human person and a divine person just sort of glued together, because that's Nestorianism, which is evil. But he is nevertheless still distinct. The human part and the divine part are distinct. They are not mixed, says the definition of Chalcedon. And the human part has got all the bits that a normal human being has. It's got a body, a mind, a will. And yet it doesn't constitute a person in its own right. And you can see this again. I mean, there are different ways you can see this, but I'm suggesting you can see this as a very similar issue. It's one of two things are sort of identical. They constitute a single person, but they're not identical because they constitute distinct natures. And I think a lot of the theological wrangling over incarnation has similarly been to try to find a middle way between the two evil heresies that somehow, you know, makes this work. And it's very difficult to do. All right, so it's the first two doctrines, Trinity and Incarnation. In each case, you've got two things or three things that seem to be identical but seem not to as well. So here's another doctrine, very different sort of doctrine, but it kind of comes down to the same thing, the doctrine of resurrection. And when I say resurrection, I mean the general resurrection of the dead, not Jesus's specific resurrection. So according to Christian orthodoxy, when you die, you're dead. But at the end of time, God will raise you, God will raise everybody en masse and judge them and send them off to their eternal destination. And this is a problem because, well, in traditional Christian theology, we have a soul as well as a body. So when you die, your soul kind of whiffles off somewhere, and then at the resurrection, it gets a new body, and it's you, because the soul is the principle of individuation of a person. So I go wherever my soul goes. So if at the end of time my soul gets a new body, that's still me, okay? But a lot of theologians today, like most philosophers, I think, don't think very much of the idea of the soul. That's not a very fashionable idea. And if you're a materialist, as many people are, it seems it's much harder to explain how that future resurrected person is the same person who dies. If I die today, and then God raises me a billion years in the future, what makes that me rather than just a sort of clone, right? And you can see, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with all sorts of problems this kind of crop up in philosophical discussions of personal identity. You know, if a mad scientist clones me and destroys the original, is that me? What if he clones me but doesn't destroy the original, is that me? And so on and so forth. Well, those sorts of philosophical discussions actually, historically speaking, started off as discussions about the resurrection. You know, people were quite obsessed with this in the 17th century. And when John Locke formulated his psychological theory of personal continuity, it was in large part to try to explain how the future you can be identical with the present you. But here again, you can see it's kind of similar, though in a different sort of a way, because again, we've got two things that seem to be identical in some sense, me now and my future resurrected counterpart, but who are not identical in some other way. Because my future resurrected counterpart doesn't share any of my matter. It's not qualitatively identical to me because Christian theology says that the future resurrected self is kind of glorified and has all kinds of properties that the current self doesn't have. So it's not even an exact clone. There's no temporal contiguity between them. You know, there's a great big gap where I don't exist at all. And it all seems, you know, everything seems to suggest that the future me isn't actually a me at all, but just another person going by the same name. So again, you've got a case where two things appear not to be identical, but somehow are supposed to be identical as well. So the Trinity, the Incarnation, Resurrection. Next one, which is functionally quite similar to resurrection, but kind of goes in the opposite direction, is original sin. Now, that's an even less fashionable sort of idea in modern theology than the soul, if such a thing can be imagined. But it's been pretty important in traditional Christian theology. And I kind of apologize for talking about it by saying I find it interesting as a philosophical thought experiment. Is there a sense in which I can be thought to be guilty for the sin of someone else? So, according again to at least Reformed orthodoxy, Adam sinned. Once he'd sinned, his tendency to sin was passed on to all his descendants, but also his guilt for that sin. So when we're born, not only do we have an inherited tendency to sin, but we're actually born guilty for Adam's sin. It seems a very harsh doctrine. And kind of problematic, because how can I be guilty of someone else's sin if I am not identical with that person? Well, the answer that Reformed theologians kind of came up with in the 16th and 17th centuries was what's called federalism, which holds that Adam is the federal head of humanity. So that means that because he's our forefather, and he's almost like our ambassador, if you like. So what he does, we sort of bear responsibility for because of that. And so although it's Adam's sin, not mine, God justly holds me guilty for it because Adam is kind of my representative. Now, I got to say, this seems ridiculous to me for a whole bunch of reasons I won't go into now. But one of the main reasons it's problematic is that it just seems intrinsic to the notion of guilt that it be you who do it, right? And this is a topic that's come up a lot in discussions of the atonement in theology, particularly with penal substitution, which is the view that Jesus is punished in the place of sinners. And a lot of people object to that on the grounds that if Jesus is innocent and I'm guilty, Jesus can't be punished on my behalf because he's innocent, right? And that's wrong. Even if he volunteers to do it, it doesn't deal with the guilt. We have a strong, intuition that moral responsibility for an act goes with the identity of the person who committed the act. If I'm guilty for something, it's because I did it. You know, someone else can't be held guilty for what I did, no matter how much I might try to argue it. So we have a similar case here. If Adam did it and I didn't, then I shouldn't be held guilty for it. And Jonathan Edwards, great 18th century American Puritan theologian, I think recognized this because he rejected that whole federalist idea that Adam kind of represents us like an ambassador. And he said, no, in fact, Adam is us. Each of us is identical with Adam in a weird kind of a way that I will go into in a little more detail later on. But he makes this doctrine about identity. Okay, so there's some sense in which I and each of you is identical with Adam, such that we can justly be held guilty for what he did. And yet at the same time, of course, we are quite blatantly not identical with Adam, at least not in the way that we are identical with ourselves. So it looks again like we've got a situation where two things, or in fact billions and billions and one thing, are sort of identical with each other and yet not identical. At least if you take that approach to the doctrine of original sin. All right, so Trinity, Incarnation, Resurrection, Original Sin. And you see they're all kind of structurally different, but they still have this theme of identity and not identity sort of cropping up. The one I'm most interested in, which I'll talk about the most, is atonement. So the doctrine of atonement, as you probably know, is quite underdetermined in Christian orthodoxy. So what I mean by that is that Christian orthodoxy states that Jesus dies and as a result believers are made right with God or something like that. And I've put it as vaguely as that because it's really not defined any more clearly or accurately. And as a result, a whole load of different ways of thinking about the atonement, of trying to explain how Jesus' death and resurrection can benefit people and how it relates to sin and what sin is. There are lots of different ways of thinking about it. But one of them, which is quite prominent in the New Testament and which has been discussed by some people quite recently, is what's known as participatory atonement. And the idea with participatory atonement is that basically everyone, or every believer at least, somehow becomes identical with Christ and takes on his properties. And that is what saves us, okay, by taking on his properties and becoming like him. But nevertheless, we are distinct people. The central text for this is Romans chapters 6 and 7. Which, just in case anyone here hasn't got that completely memorized by heart, it's where Paul talks about how Christ makes it possible for believers to escape their old life of sin and begin a new one. And I shall even read a bit out. He says, "Do you not know that all of us," this is from the start of Romans chapter 6, "do you not know that all of us who have been baptized into Christ Jesus were baptized into his death? Therefore, we've been buried with him by baptism into death, so that just as Christ was raised from the dead by the glory of the Father, so we too might walk in newness of life. For if we have been united with him in a death like his, we will certainly be united with him in a resurrection like his." So, and he goes on in that vein for a bit longer. And if you look at that as a philosophical theologian, as I unfortunately do, it kind of looks like an attempt to explain how Christ's death and resurrection save believers. And you might say that in a passage like that, Paul is thinking of sin as something that afflicts human identity, if you like. It's a kind of, it's almost like a sickness. It's an ontological reality that corrupts human nature, destroys relationships, and leads people to disobey God. So, on this view, sin isn't really something that people do. It's not bad stuff that you do and that you get blamed for, although it leads to that. It's something that's kind of wrong with who you are, with your identity as a human being. And Paul thinks that the only way that's so powerful that the only way you can escape it is literally by dying. It's like a terminal disease. But, he says, we can participate in Christ via faith and the sacraments. And that allows us to share Christ's death, right? Because Christ died, if we participate in him, if we somehow identify with him, we can share his death. And that allows us to die to sin without having to actually go through the unpleasant business of dying. It also means that we can share in his resurrection and gain new identities. So as a result of all of this, we can be remade with new identities, free from the power of sin and the guilt and various unpleasant consequences that it brings along with it. So central to this is participation. And, you know, Paul doesn't flesh this out at all, which is why viewing the atonement in this way hasn't been very common in Christian history, at least not exclusively in this way. But some philosophical theologians and philosophers of religion recently, and biblical theologians as well, have tried to argue that this kind of idea should be more central to Christian thinking about the atonement. And it does seem to have a lot to do with identity. I mean, the idea, as far as I can tell, the logic behind it seems to be that through faith, the believers are so much one with Christ that they acquire his properties. So it's kind of a theological version of Leibniz's law, right? If X is identical with Y, then X has all the properties that Y does. Well, if I am identical with Christ, at least in whatever sense of identical with we're using here, I acquire his properties. I acquire his properties of having died to sin and of going to be raised from the dead. At least Paul always thinks that's something in the future rather than the past. I'm going to skip a load of benefits of this. Big problem with it, though, of course, is that participation seems problematic, right? It seems obvious that I am not identical with Christ, neither are any of you, neither is anyone. You could put it in a sort of metaphorical sense. So you could say that maybe I identify with Christ in the same way that the sports fan identifies with their team. You know, we lost at the weekend in a sort of a way, even though, you know, the person saying that didn't actually play in the game. That might work, but then it makes the whole thing a kind of big metaphor, and it just makes it basically a subjective model of the atonement, which subjective models of the atonement basically say we're inspired by Jesus's example to live better lives, and that's sort of what salvation is. And there's not necessarily anything wrong with that, but this model stops being interesting if it just turns out to be that in metaphorical language. So what we need to do is to find a way in which I and you can be considered identical with Christ such that we take on some of his properties. But no, not all of his properties. You know, we don't all become Galilean carpenters. And similarly, the exchange only goes one way. You know, Jesus doesn't take on the properties of the Christian, fortunately for him. So it seems that if this is going to work at all, it's going to be a pretty weird notion of identity, such that some properties are exchanged but not others, and such that we can talk about identity and yet distinctness. So I hope you can see again, this is structurally similar to some of those other doctrines. I think particularly it's similar to the doctrine of incarnation. Okay. Again, remember, with incarnation, at least on the model I was talking about, you've got Jesus of Nazareth, a human being walking around in Galilee with a body, a mind, etc., whatever it is that human beings have, who is somehow, in some sense, identical with a divine member of the Trinity, and yet, at the same time, in some sense, not identical with him, because the natures are distinct. Similarly with the atonement, there is some sense, on this model of the atonement, on Paul's view of it, in which the Christian is identical with Christ, or to make it even the parallel even more obvious, with God, and yet is distinct. Also, I should say, if you don't like that model of atonement, these sorts of ideas and this sort of language crops up in other ways of thinking of the atonement as well. So good example here, again, is penal substitution, which I mentioned earlier. So again, penal substitution is the idea that salvation works because sin is a matter of me being guilty of doing horrible things. It's not a sort of contagion of myself. It's bad things I've done. I need to be punished for it, so God punishes Jesus in my place. And of course, the major objection to that, or one of the many objections to that, is that you can't justly punish an innocent person on behalf of a guilty one. well, what if we appeal to this idea of the identity between between Christ and the Christian? What if we say there is some sense in which Jesus is actually me? And we apply that not to this idea of me appropriating his death and dying to sin, but what if we relate that to the idea of him being punished for my sin? So Oliver Crisp has done this. He's kind of developed a model of penal substitution that tries to get around that objection by appealing to the identity of Christ and the sinner. So it's an idea, this identity between Christ and the sinner, that can be applied to different models of the atonement. I've kind of characterized it in terms of this participatory model, but it can apply to others as well, and might, you know, help them get around objections like that. All right, I hope that made some sense. The last doctrine I will mention follows on quite neatly from that, and it's theosis, divinization. So, as you probably know, this is a really big thing in Orthodox, with a capital O, Christianity, Eastern Christianity, that traditionally views the spiritual life as one not simply of becoming close to God or knowing God or ultimately getting to see God, which is kind of the traditional Western view of heaven, but of actually becoming God in some sense. So to Eastern Orthodox theologians, the ultimate goal of human nature is to be transformed, to become literally divine in some way. The traditional way of viewing it is that the believer becomes united to God such that she shares his properties, but not his nature. Maximus the Confessor, great 7th century theologian, put it like that. We share God's properties, but not his nature. Which, just on a sidebar, is a bit odd, because kind of the classic proof text of this in the Bible is 2 Peter 1:5, which actually states outright that we do share God's nature, not just his properties, but his actual nature. So so that's the case where the biblical text is actually more radical and shocking than the later theological tradition, but that's by the by. Anyway, the point is, you can see here again, it's a similar situation. Somehow, in the future, in the eschaton, you know, this is far in the future, human beings, maybe all human beings, if you're a universalist, will become united to God to such an extent that they can be called divine, that they will share his properties, but at the same time will remain distinct in some way. So there's a kind of very delicate line to tread here. On the one hand, Christ is seen, and this again is using Pauline language, Christ is seen as the first fruits. Paul calls him in 1 Corinthians 15, Christ is the first fruits of those who have died. That means he is kind of the prototype. What happens to him happens to everyone. Just as Christ is glorified and made one with the Father, so everyone will be glorified and made one with the Father. But at the same time, Orthodoxy tells us that we will not be exactly like Christ. There was a heretical movement in the 5th and 6th centuries called the Isochristes, who thought that we are all like Christ. They got very condemned for it. So somehow there's got to be this line again. Somehow there's identity between human beings and God, and yet somehow it's not identity as well. All right, so those are the six doctrines that I think have this kind of isomorphism, if you like. They've got this problem of identity. And I would group them not by the order I've just listed them in, but in a slightly different way, according to the kind of identity problem that they involve. So I'd say there's three groups. The first group is a problem of identity between divine individuals. And that's the doctrine of the Trinity. That's the only one in that group. The next is identity, and identity here is a big question mark after it. Identity question mark between divine and non-divine individuals. So that's the incarnation, the atonement, and theosis. I think those are all structurally very similar, at least in the terms where I've discussed them. And you can see how that differs, right? The Trinity, you've got three divine people, persons, I should say, who are somehow identical with each other, but not. With these ones, you've got a divine person, or maybe the Trinity as a whole, and you've got human individuals who are somehow identical with the divine but not incarnation, atonement, and theosis, all in different ways. With incarnation, it's Jesus. With atonement and theosis, it's everyone. And then the last category is identity over time between non-divine individuals. And the two doctrines here are original sin and resurrection. So that's a kind of, you can see that that's a different, it's slightly different sort of problem. Yeah, how or in what sense at all am I identical with Adam in the past? How, in what sense, if at all, am I identical with my resurrected counterpart in the future? Even though I don't seem to be identical with either of them by any normal account. But but all of them, it's all about identity, sort of. All right, so that's my problem. Can we find a way of thinking about identity that's going to make all of these, or all right, maybe slightly less ambitious, some of these make sense? Okay, can we find a notion of identity that allows different individuals in these different circumstances to be sort of identical but not quite identical? Well, I'm not sure we can, which is why I want to ask you whether you think we can. I'll go over the sort of main candidates for ways to get around this. Okay, so what's the principle of individuation? Well, there's a bunch of traditional answers, and I suppose the simplest one is heceities, thisnesses in Latin. And the idea here is that every individual thing has a thisness. I will call it thisness rather than heceity. And that's what makes it this thing rather than that thing. So, you know, what makes this phone and that phone, apart from the fact that that's obviously a much better phone than this, it's that it just has, you know, even if they were identical, that just has thisness and this has thatness, as it were. It's not necessarily a tremendously illuminating explanation. That's the terminology of Duns Scotus, of course. He invented this terminology. But you might also see similar accounts in other philosophers. So John Locke, for example, when he talks about substance, a Lockean substance is really pretty much a heceity, a thisness, because it's this kind of, you know, it's a pincushion that holds all of the properties that an object supposedly has, but isn't identical with any of them. It's just this sort of mysterious I know not what that's kind of floating underneath and makes something this thing rather than that thing. All right, well, is this going to help us at all? Well, leaving aside any issues there might be with this account of individuation, I don't think it's going to help us very much. And the reason is, heceities, something, well, they are, things either have them or they don't. You know, there's no, it's binary. You know, this has this heceity, that has that heceity, there's an end to it. But what we're looking for is an account that would allow two things to be sort of identical without actually being identical or something like that. We're looking for fuzzy identity, basically. And heceities just won't do that, I don't think. So leave those alone. Well, the main rival to that sort of approach to individuality and the problem of individuation and identity is qualitative accounts. So qualitative accounts are those that pick up on some property or set of properties that a thing has, and those supposedly individuate that thing. So a classic example of this is Thomas Aquinas's notion of matter. Right. And I know that technically speaking, matter isn't really a property, but I'm going to call it a property just for the sake of this. So Aquinas thinks that what makes this phone distinct from that phone is that this phone is made of this bunch of matter and that phone is made of that bunch of matter. And it's the different lumps of matter that individuate the different things. Well, and so to put it into Aristotelian terms, as Aquinas unfortunately does all the time, you can say that form is what specifies the kind of thing we're talking about, and matter is what individuates members of that species that share qualitatively the same form. So it's quite a neat way of looking at things. Form gives you the whatness, and matter gives you the thisness. Duns Scotus pointed out, of course, that this doesn't work because you may say that this phone is this phone because it's made of this matter. Well, what makes that matter, as opposed to that matter? You've just pushed the problem back one. Leaving that aside, I again am not sure that this is going to help very much with our problems. This is partly because with the doctrines of Trinity, Incarnation, Atonement, and Theosis, we're talking about immaterial things, right? We're talking about God or divine beings that are identical with each other or with material things. I don't see how this account of identity is going to help with doctrines that involve immaterial things. Original sin and resurrection, I clump those together as dealing with things purely on the human level, so that looks more promising. But it doesn't really, because those involve discontinuities in matter. You know, if what makes me me is the fact that I'm made out of this stuff, then I'm very clearly not Adam, because he was made out of different stuff, and I'm very clearly not my future resurrected counterpart, because he's made out of different stuff as well. So this way of looking at identity and individuation, I think, is also not going to work for the problems I'm looking at. So we'll get rid of that as well. Another kind of qualitative account that looks at properties is, rather than picking up on the property of being made of this material, to put it rather crudely, is to look at the complete set of properties. So this is the principle of the identity of indiscernibles, okay, which is the reverse of the indiscernibility of identicals. Just to flesh that out a bit more, Leibniz's law is the principle of the indiscernibility of identicals. If two things are really exactly the same thing, then they share all properties in common. That seems straightforward. If Bruce Wayne is really Batman, then anything that's true of Bruce Wayne is also true of Batman. All theological problems can basically be resolved into problems of Batman, I've found. The reverse is the identity of indiscernibles, which is more associated with Leibniz and which is a lot more controversial, and which is that if two things have exactly the same, qualitatively exactly the same properties, then they are in fact the same thing. Or to put it differently, two things can't be exactly similar in every respect. That's trivially true if we count literally all properties, including all relational ones, but it's more interesting if we count only monadic properties, right? Only intrinsic properties, not relational ones. So in this view, I am me because I have the same properties that I do. I am me tomorrow because I have the same properties that I tomorrow have, at least if they are time indexed. And so I could be the future resurrected me if I have the same properties as the future resurrected me, again, at least if they're time indexed, assuming that the future me has some different ones. The problem is, none of the things... I'm not sure what to make of this. I think again, that this isn't really going to help us, because in all of the cases we're looking at, the things in question are not qualitatively exactly similar, except for the Trinity. So, for example, so take the incarnation. What is it that makes Jesus of Nazareth identical in some sense with the Son, that is the second person of the Trinity? Well, it can't be being qualitatively exactly the same, because he's not qualitatively exactly the same, right? He's physical, he's walking around, he's limited, etc., etc., etc. So I don't think this is going to help either. I'm sorry to be so negative about all these views, but it's these are views of identity that are, if you like, designed to account for normal identity in the normal world, and they break down when you try to apply them to this kind of thing. Well, here's an alternative. What if we swap it around? What if instead of thinking that intrinsic properties individuate, what if extrinsic ones do? So what if it's all about relational properties rather than monadic ones? For example, spatiotemporal location. So what makes this phone distinct from that phone is that they occupy different locations. And we might, if we have a relational view of space, time, think that that is a matter of the relations between the two objects. And Gregory of Nyssa, a great 4th century theologian who I like, he had an account very like this for the Trinity. So Gregory says that... in the case of the Trinity, you've got three persons who are basically members of the same kind. He says that the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit are to each other what Peter, James, and John are to each other, different members of the same class. And that immediately looks like tritheism, right? If the members of the Trinity are three, only in the sense that three people are three, then they're three gods. But Gregory goes on to say, but what individuates three people are things like they're made of different matter, they locate different, they are located at different points in space, and things like that. And none of that applies to the Trinity. So although the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit are three members of the same class, they are actually far more united than three members of the same class in the physical world are. In particular, they don't occupy different locations or have the other distinguishing features of physical objects. So they are one God, says Gregory. And there are, just again, there are different ways of interpreting Gregory of Nyssa, but that's kind of one way of interpreting him. And it's also going, so what makes them three at all and not one? It's because their relations to each other. Their relations to each other are different. So the Father is the Father of the Son is the Son of the Father. That's the only thing that distinguishes them. That's going to require a strongly realist view of relations, at least in the Trinity, if you're talking about that, and in other things, if you're going to apply it to that as well. You can't view relations as identical to monadic predicates, not reducible to monadic predicates, not even supervening on monadic predicates. You've got to be able to have it so that two things can have exactly the same intrinsic properties, qualitatively exactly the same, and yet have different relations. Well, maybe you can do that. Could you apply it to other problems? The other theological problems. Well, Jonathan Edwards, just to get back to him, he hints at something like this, and I think this is really interesting. I think it is, anyway. There's a brief entry in his Miscellanies. Edwards kept this sort of theological journal, it was a sort of theological diary that he kept throughout his whole life, called the Miscellanies, in which he kind of jotted down lots of incredibly original creative ideas that he never then picked up on later on. So, you know, Edwards scholars can argue about what he meant about them. And there's one where he's talking about the incarnation, and he addresses the incarnation in exactly the terms I gave earlier as a problem of identity. How is it that Jesus of Nazareth is identical with, in some sense, well, definitely identical with the second person of the Trinity? And Edwards says, and I'll quote him here, "'Tis not just any communion of understanding and will that makes the same person, but the communion of understanding is such that there is the same consciousness." So that there is a kind of statement of a Lockean psychological view of human identity, right? What makes two people the same person is continuity of consciousness, says Edwards. The communion of understanding is such that there's the same consciousness. I'm the same person I was yesterday because the same consciousness has persisted through. I remember being me yesterday. I have the same personality. Thus, says Edwards, the man Christ Jesus was conscious of the glory and blessedness the Logos had in the knowledge and enjoyment of the Father before the world was. He has the same spiritual disposition towards the Father, not as believers have a filial spirit or spirit of children, but he has the spirit of the only begotten of the Father. He is disposed towards the Father as being his own Father in the manner that he is the Father of the Logos. So that's a very torturous way of saying that Jesus has, if you like, the same consciousness as the second person of the Trinity. He has the same relation to the Father that the second person of the Trinity does. The second person of the Trinity, the Son, is the Son of the Father. The Son remembers being the Son of the Father before time began, and so on and so forth. Similarly, says Edwards, Jesus has exactly that same attitude, those same relations to the Father. Therefore, suggests Edwards, he is the Son. I think, at least it looks like he's hinting that what makes the Son of the Father is that he has these certain relations towards the Father. And that, so in the case of the Trinity, identity is constituted by relations. And so he applies that to Jesus as well. Jesus's identity is also constituted by the same relations. Because he bears those relations to the Father that the Son does, he is the Son. You've got to have a kind of view that only the Son can bear those relations to the Father, of course. It's got to be somehow unique. All right, so I'll skip through the rest of the details of Edward's account there. But I hope you can see how that, at least potentially, is a way of getting identity of a kind to work between Jesus and the Son. Suppose we accept that it works there. Suppose we accept that it works in the Trinity, which is where it is traditionally applied. Could it work for the others? Well, I think it arguably could for atonement and theosis. If it works for incarnation, it'll work for atonement and theosis because those are structurally so similar. So you might say, for example, with theosis, believers becoming divine is a matter of believers acquiring the same relations to the divine that Jesus had, or the same relations that constitute the relationships between the different persons of the Trinity, or something like that. It's going to be rather difficult to flesh out. But ultimately, you know, if one day I will have such a perfect vision of God, such perfect union with God, that I will have the same attitude towards God and he will have the same attitude towards me that existed between God and Jesus, there will be a sense in which I could be said to be identical with God in the same way that Jesus could be said to be identical with him, or something like that. Will it work in the details? I don't know. I'm just vaguely hinting at it. Not so sure about original sin and resurrection. I don't think it's going to work there. Because the idea that identity over time has something to do with the relations between the different temporal slices, that's quite a common idea. But here, the relations that hold between me and Adam in the past and between me and my future resurrected self, they're not the relations that normally hold between me right now and me just now, or me just a moment in the future. You know, so it looks like an account like that isn't going to work here if we're making it relational. So the relational account, I think, works for those doctrines that involve God. Doesn't work quite so well with ones on the human level. Will I talk about relative identity? I'm not going to talk about relative identity because that's a complicated topic. I will skip over that. I'll finish with just one last issue. Just suffice to say, I don't think relative identity is going to work either. Last one I'm just going to talk about, and this is because I stuck the word entanglement into the title of this to seem, you know, cool and trendy, so I'm going to have to mention it at the end. Those of you who came for entanglement, I'm sorry you had to sit through all of that. But basically, and I'm not a quantum physicist any more than I'm a metaphysician, so everything I'm going to say here is probably wrong, but at least on some interpretations, quantum mechanics does away with identity altogether. So particles or fields can be specified solely in terms of their properties without being assigned distinct locations or trajectories, which, again, on some interpretations, means that the question, is this particle the same one as a particle that existed earlier? Or even, is this particle here identical with that particle over there? Become meaningless, right? Because sameness and differentness don't apply in quantum statistics. You know, it's like saying in the sum 2 plus 3 equals 5 and 2 times 8 equals 16. Is that the same 2 occurring in each case? That's a category mistake if you were to ask that. Similarly, quantum phenomena don't have instances. And you might say, you know, this is shown in things like entanglement, where it looks like you've got two particles, but there's a sort of a sense in which they're only really one particle. You know, they're not really two particles sharing properties. It's you could just as well call it one particle existing in two places at the same time, even if you could call it particles at all. Now, does this sort of thing help us? Well, in some ways, it might seem to, okay? Because if identity breaks down at the quantum level, or things can be considered identical or not identical depending on your taste, that seems analogous to theological problems. But if the reason for this underdetermination of identity at the quantum level is that identity doesn't even exist at the quantum level, if identity as we know it is just a property of the macroscopic world, the world that we see around us, and it's not really a fundamental feature of reality, then that's problematic. Maybe it will work with the Trinity, because the Trinity is totally outside the phenomenal realm, okay? If identity as we know it is just something that we see around us and not a fundamental feature of reality, then maybe it's okay for God to be three and yet one at the same time, because that would only be a problem if he existed at the physical level, but he doesn't. But applying it on the other doctrines is problematic because there we're dealing with things at the human level as well. I mean, if, you know, if I'm going to be myself in the future in the resurrection, there has to be real identity. If I am genuinely guilty of Adam's sin, then there must be real identity between me and Adam, because notions of personal identity and notions of moral responsibility do depend on some kind of identity being real, you know, at some level. So it seems to me that that approach to identity might help with some of these doctrines, but maybe not others. So I'll come sort of shuddering to a close at that point. Basically, what I've been saying is I think that all of these doctrines have similar issues at their heart. And the different approaches to identity that I've mentioned, and there are others that I've skipped, they possibly might seem to help at some levels with some of them. But I find it very hard to find any approach to identity that's going to work with all of them. So I've kind of done a bait and switch. You know, I've held out the promise of possibly finding a unifying problem that unifies all of the problems of Christian theology, or at least some of them, and the possibility of a single solution to them all, but I can't find it. So if those with greater metaphysical ability than me are able to find it, I'd be very interested.